Okay, I did manage to squeeze in some time away from reading and writing email to finish grading the exams. At least I thought I was finished. It turns out there are a few little stragglers that I have to grade over the noon hour that didn't, for some reason, didn't get printed out on ExamSoft. But that should be done, and I'm thinking they should be done. Well, they should be done by 2 or so. In any event, what I'll do is, as soon as they're ready, Suzanne will send out an email that says they're ready, and will say when you can pick them up. So, you know, whether it's going to be down here or up there or, you know, some other place where they can be picked up. Any questions? Okay. Yeah, you have a question. Good, good. Oh, you know, that's the other thing I haven't done when I discovered I was not dealing from a full deck. It interrupted the process whereby I transferred the grades in such a form that I could then give you the average or the spread or whatever. They looked very normal, as I've said before, some very high. Some low, most in the middle. So, as I say, a very sort of normal distribution. Yeah. I'm just a keep up with the Joneses guy here. Whatever the standard operating procedure is, if that's standardly in use, I'll let it. If it's not standardly in use, I won't. So, other questions? Okay, then let's talk about wrongful death. As I said, Wednesday we had a lot of discussion about the history, the derivation of the law of wrongful death. It turns out to be a little bit odd. Of course, it's odd anyway because the task by itself is rather daunting. How do I, you know, place a value of a compensatory nature on the difference between life and death? By the same token, it wouldn't be different in kind from trying to evaluate the amount of compensation for the loss of an arm or for the loss of one's eyesight or hearing or a disfiguring facial injury or that sort of thing. What compensation we set is always a difficult process. What's different about wrongful death, as we have seen, is that instead of being worked over by courts, tweaked and adjusted, it got turned over to the legislature. And everything hinges on what the legislature has written up in the statute authorizing a wrongful death recovery. Of course, the courts have to interpret these statutes, and I would say that courts tend to err on the side of generosity to the extent that a remedy could be interpreted in a way that would provide a meaningful recovery as distinguished from one that wouldn't. A court will look for a way to make it a meaningful remedy. On the other hand, where the statute seems to fairly clearly state that this is the measure of damages, the court's going to follow that, even if the court might, if it were up to them as a policy matter, write a very different statute. So again, we're kind of in this world in which there's a little delicate dance between the court and the legislature. Let's start with the First National Bank of Meadville case. Again, what we're doing in this case and the next case is looking at a real-life situation and watching the way the court handles a case like this The preparation for the exam in the fall should be getting ready to take a fact pattern if there's a wrongful death claim that's involved, turning to the statute that I will give to you, and figuring out what a court would likely do interpreting that statute and applying it. So we're getting a chance to see that done here. Okay, can somebody tell us about the First National Bank of Meadville? Go ahead. Mr. Fowler, right?
Yes.
Go ahead. And again, the executor is somebody who simply follows the instructions, acts on behalf of the estate to make sure that what was intended by the person who left the will or what is provided for in the statute in terms of the distribution of a decedent's assets, that is carried out, that those are executed. Brought to fruition. Okay, so the bank, that's who the First National Bank of Meadville is here, they're the executor, they filed a claim against this company. Okay, so again, Chapter 1, Chapter 2 are essentially resolved here. There's negligence. The negligence proximately caused the death. What we're doing here in Chapter 3 is saying, okay, so what does that mean? What's the measure of damages?
So for wrongful death,
let me just pause before we go any further and say, what were the two questions I left you with on Wednesday? When you confront a wrongful death case, what two questions do you want to have answered? Mr. Sharma? Yeah. The who question and the what question. What's the who question? Who's on first, what's on second? What is this who question? If that makes any sense. Yeah. So we want to know, we're measuring damages to whom? That's the first question. And what are our alternatives as a general proposition, looking out over the landscape of wrongful death statutes? They fall out into two major groups, although you could sort of mix and match them. But what are our alternatives in terms of who? But in general, if you're saying, gee, there are different kinds of wrongful death statutes, they answer the who question in different ways. What are the different ways you can answer that who question? Mr. Boyd? Okay, so we refer to a kind of statute, a so-called wrongful death statute. Again, it's confusing because the whole thing comes under the generic heading wrongful death, but what we mean by a wrongful death type statute is it is one which directs the recovery toward the family of the decedent to say they're the real ones who've been injured. Let's compensate them. So again, this is essentially the family or the relatives of the decedent. That's one form, that's one way to answer the who question. The other way to answer the who question is, Mr. Breck? Okay. Yeah, I think you said the alternative would be to compensate the decedent. What we mean there would be the decedent's estate. And the argument in favor of this is called a survival statute. It's not the survival of the decedent. It's not favoring the survivors, like the family. The concept behind this form of wrongful death recovery is, let's treat the claim for wrongful death the same way we treat other assets in the decedent's estate. If I'm Bill Gates and I die, given as much money as I have, I will have thought about this in advance. I will provide by my last will and testament directions for how I want my money distributed. Typically, I'll give some of it to my family. I may give some of it to charity. I will decide, you know, whether it's my first wife or my, you know, brother-in-law or whatever it is, who among the various people I want to receive what's left when I die. Again, the idea over here is to say, let the recovery from this tort suit be treated as an asset in that estate. We've already got the mechanism, or should have the mechanism, up and running. Simply put that money in there and let it flow in whatever direction the decedent chose. That gives again, the argument is not only sort of simplicity, we've already got the mechanism in place, let's just add this as an item in the asset column, but it's also a way of saying this comes the closest to honoring the true victim of the negligent act or of this breach of duty. Again, the argument against that, the argument in favor of the so-called wrongful death format, favoring the family, is to say that this is reality, this is theory. This is the kind of thing law professors dream up because it looks good on paper, but the reality is that the flesh and blood people who actually cared about this person ought to be the ones that we take into account. So, different people are impressed with different ways of starting out the analysis. Now, that's the who question. The second question is the what question. What kind of a question is the what question? What elements, such as? What are our choices? What's on the menu here? Specifically, the economic loss. So one kind of what we could include would be, how much has the family suffered economically? Suppose I'm in a classic, you know, Ozzie and Harriet, Leave It to Beaver family. Father's the breadwinner, mom is a homemaker, etc. Dad gets killed. We look at what dad would have provided to the family, the economic loss. Or alternatively, for purposes of the estate, how much money would this person have accumulated in life? How much less has the estate been forced to forego because of the premature death of this person? And how much do we have to fill the tank up, so to speak, to put it back where it was before the injury? Now, that's economic loss. What other items might be on our shopping list here of things the who's would want to collect? Okay, so in the case, for example, of mesothelioma or some other long, you know, cancer-type fading away as opposed to a sudden, you know, death in a plane crash, in a case like mesothelioma or something else, you have maybe 6 months of expensive hospital care as the person gradually loses their fight with this disease. That can be a lot of money. Again, a form of economic loss similar to lost income from wages. Anything else on our shopping list? Ms. Ma? You might want to say that unlike the average case where you get a broken arm, in the case of a wrongful death, we want to provide an attorney's fee. Then again, you may say this is really no different from other tort cases where our rule is everybody's on their own. So that's something we might put on our... There's something else we've left out here, Ms. Johnson? Yes, the non-economic loss, particularly in the case, for example, where you lose somebody who's not a breadwinner or economic powerhouse. If, God forbid, I should lose my child through somebody's negligence, my child is no economic asset to me. Although my children, as the bumper sticker says, be nice to your children, they'll pick out your nursing home. Although eventually I may depend upon them in some way, I'm not planning on making any money on my kids. So if the measure of damage is, okay, DeWolf, we're going to give you everything you lost economically from the loss of your child, but we're not going to look at all at the non-economic loss, what kind of a deal would that be? So the plaintiff would certainly argue in favor of a recovery of non-economic losses. Similarly, the estate would say, if we're going to compensate the decedent for death, in effect, if somebody ran over me tomorrow, maybe my best years economically are yet to come, but suppose I get run over by a truck the day I retire. And I wasn't planning on making any more money, but I was planning on having some fun. Does that not get compensated? Am I only looked at as an economic creature here, not as someone capable of enjoying things in life? So on both sides of the equation, actually, this is not an equation, but either way you structure the compensation, you can make an argument for non-economic damages. But remember, it doesn't matter what you or I think, or even what the court thinks would be sound public policy. What matters is what the legislature chooses. They made a decision about what to compensate and what not to compensate, and if they left something off the list, I'm so sorry, but that's the way it is. Again, a court looking at a case in which the statute appears to say to the parent of a grieving, to a grieving parent who's lost a child to the defendant's negligence, rather than say, oh, gee, the legislature only said you get your economic loss, so you have a hospital bill of $4,000 and a funeral of $8,000. Enjoy. You've been compensated. To the extent that the court has anything to say about that, they're going to try to figure out a way that the legislature is going to not look quite so bad. One of the phrases, by the way, that you'll see here is the phrase pecuniary damages. Pecuniary, as you sort of sounds, pecuniary is simply the Latin word, you know, for money. I'm impecunious, I don't have any money. So when a court says, when a legislature says the parent or the spouse or whoever is entitled to the pecuniary damages suffered by the death or as a result of death, some people would say, well, pecuniary means like economic loss, wage loss, medical expense, stuff that affects your bank balance. Other people would say, no, wait a minute. Pecuniary damages just mean money damages. So as long as the jury is awarding money damages, that's fair game. So let's allow an award for the parents, or they sometimes refer to loss of services. And this could have a really crude meaning to it, but when it was written into statutes, you know, the loss of services, the idea was of a more humble kind of, I've just been watching Frontier House. My son rented it from the library, and I wound up watching some episodes. It's that PBS thing where these people go back and live in Montana, I think it is, and rough it for a while, pretend they're out on the frontier. Anyway, it reminds me of an era in which services would be things like chopping wood and washing clothes and cooking and doing services that, again, you could identify even what children were able to do. So my children were valuable to me. The loss of services would be things like my kids would bring me my slippers at night, or take out the garbage, or do the dishes, or what have you. But maybe loss of services can include the services that my child provides to me by way of some kind of emotional satisfaction. Can I include that as a service that my child provides? My child comforts me in my moments of loneliness and sense of futility in life. I see my child and I think, oh, well, maybe my life's not so worthless after all. Is that a service, the loss of which I can be compensated for? Again, when you look at the statute, as I said earlier, you want to say, is there any play here where I can squeeze out of this statute something beyond the economic loss? Because in many cases, that's where the action is. Or am I stuck saying, will the court be stuck saying, gee, it's too bad the legislature didn't provide a more meaningful kind of remedy, but you know, we aren't the legislature. And we're stuck. Okay. Meanwhile, back in New York here with the First National Bank of Meadville, let's answer the who question with respect to this statute. What kind of statute? It's not in New York, actually. It's in Pennsylvania, isn't it? At least it's the law of Pennsylvania that we're applying. What has Pennsylvania chosen as the who of recovery here? Okay, let's pause there. Interestingly, Pennsylvania has said, why not both? In that sense, they say there are losses that can be identified to both entities here. As you say, the loss, first of all, the decedent in this case, Kenneth Rice, it was a kind of Warden June Cleaver Ozzie and Harriet kind of deal here. He's a lawyer, he makes all the money. The wife and kids daughters are dependent upon him financially. So their loss is first measure. Again, it's a little bit crass here. We treat him like a goose who laid golden eggs, and you done kill my goose here. I want you to compensate me. I want to figure out, count how many eggs this golden eggs this goose was going to lay, and that's the number of, that's the measure of my compensation. So again, the wife and daughters here are entitled to just as Mrs. O'Shea was looking forward to working and receiving wages, Mrs. Rice and the two daughters look forward to the money they would have received from Kenneth Rice continuing to earn an income and bringing that home. How about the estate? What's if we compensate them? What are we going to do with respect to the estate? How can there also be compensation for the estate? Mr. Boyer? Right. Again, we would assume that while they, like good American consumers, would spend a lot of what is earned, the assumption is at some point the amount of money that Kenneth Rice earned would be built up in the form of an estate. Now, again, just as in the case of Mrs. O'Shea, we don't speak of generalities here so much as we speak of specifics. What was Kenneth Rice's economic future? Was he on the verge of getting disbarred, fired from his company? Was he on the verge of being made the president of some new conglomerate? Was he on the verge of quitting the practice of law and becoming a school teacher? What were his economic prospects? How did he live? Was he a miser who saved every penny, made his family shop at the thrift stores so that they could buy investment property and duplexes and things like that? Again, it might affect whether you say small amount of spending on the family, huge amount going into the estate, or the other way around. He would spend his money as fast as he could get it, and at the rate he was going, the estate would be lucky not to go broke. Does it make any difference which column we put it in this case? The beneficiaries of the estate in this case are the same as the beneficiaries of the wrongful death case, but you could easily imagine, it's not some far-fetched hypothetical, that there are two different sets of beneficiaries. Suppose Mr. Rice had become estranged from his wife and children. He was looking for new opportunities in life. And in fact, he was seeing a lot of this person to whom he had, and let's suppose he'd drawn up a new will. And in his will, he left everything to this new interest that he had. Or supposing he'd become a religious nut and had decided he's going to give all his money to some charitable enterprise or to the Humane Society or some other charity. Again, it would make a huge difference. Now we have to worry about whether we expected him to earn a lot of money and spend it on his wife and children, or whether there was going to be a little bit over here but a lot over there. As with the case of Mrs. O'Shea, we're engaged in this kind of, it's more like fiction writing than measuring the width of that wall over there. Somebody's got to do it, though. And the value of a case depends upon the outcome of our effort to try to describe this as best we can. So again, Pennsylvania says we're going to have both. Whatever goes to the family, whatever would have gone to the family goes to the family. Whatever is left over goes to the estate, and let each of those take according to the distribution that's worked out. What about non-economic damages? No non-economic damages? But is that a non-economic contribution, or is that an economic contribution, like paying their college tuition or that sort of thing? It's economic, isn't it? There's nothing in this whole award that reflects anything other than economic value. So while Pennsylvania is very generous in terms of saying, let's have both, when it comes to the what question, they say it's all about money. So again, if Kenneth Rice had been, you know, a disabled guy who lived on Social Security, disability income, if he'd been retired, we'd say, harm? What harm? Nobody lost a dime because of his death. And the court would have to either twist and do something with the statute to wring something out of it, or the court would shrug its shoulders and say, yeah, this stinks, but tell the legislature, get them to change the statute. We didn't write this statute. Don't look at us. Mr. Boyer? Like this one? Again, if you were on a jury looking at a case like this, let's suppose it was a, you know, disabled guy, and he lived with his sister and her husband. You know, maybe there's something in there about loss of services. And maybe if you were looking at it on the outside, you would say, well, gee, the disabled brother, you know, they took him places and they, you know, they, you know, what services? But if the alternative is essentially to say there's no damage, then again, that might be your avenue in which you say, oh, the services that he provided were, you know, and you put the sister and the brother-in-law on the witness stand to talk about what it was like when he raked the leaves for them, or when he took their dog for a walk, or did something else. And maybe there wouldn't be a dry eye in the courtroom when they're done. And the jury is looking at this, and instead of saying, oh, you manipulative, first, how can you try to con your way into getting some money out of this? The jury might say, well, anything less would be uncivilized. So, but again, the degree of flexibility is limited by just how much play there is in the statute, and maybe there are previous court cases that say, nice try, I know you meant well, but you've really taken over for the legislature here, and you're trying to fix something that the legislature has to fix, and this is the way it is. Yeah. Well, it depends on the way the debt is contracted. So if the debt is personal, the debt dies with the debtor, although there may be claims, you know, again, the way the death statute is written, it may say, in effect, the claims against the debtor have to be satisfied with whatever recovery there is before you start paying out beneficiaries. It doesn't make much sense to say, oh, he's dead, he can't pay his Visa bill, but oh, by the way, here are these people that are getting $350,000 in compensation for his wrongful death. So the statute, again, may provide for a subtraction of the debts from the assets, or then again, it may not. So you simply have to look at what has been provided. Let's move on then to our second case here, the Feldman case. These are not easy cases. From the standpoint that they, I see how that would go, and I nod my head at the result. You kind of scratch your head and say, where did they come up with this? But on the other hand, you say, as you look at it, I'm not sure that there was a clear, bright line answer for this. Mr. Breck?
Right.
Right. It does appear there's some double counting here. And if you looked at it and said to yourself, gee, I don't think they did the math quite right here. I've had accounting students tell me that there was a mistake here, and I don't claim any expertise in this area to be able to say one way or the other. But again, one of the things to notice is the way in which, again, the court looks at a future stream of income, but then discounts that to its present value. But how you allocate it as between the wrongful death claim on the one hand and the survival act claim on the other is a matter of judgment. Okay, Feldman. Can somebody tell us, again, what we're interested in Feldman is what's the general lay of the land here? What's the general pattern of the way the case is laid out? Who's in the driver's seat? What's the measure of damage? Mr. Brett. Okay, so again, this is very much like Mrs. O'Shea. We look into the future. We try to figure out, well, how long would she work? What salary would she earn? What advancements, you know, in her career? How would that affect her income? At what point would she say, I've had enough of this. I'm going to go do something else? We're essentially fiction writers here. We're making up a story about Nancy Feldman's life. It's a lot more of a blank canvas than with Mrs. O'Shea. Mrs. O'Shea was more of a known quantity in terms of her work history, what she wanted to do, what she was capable of doing. Nancy Feldman is harder to project because she hasn't even started law school, much less finished it, identified whether she wants to be a criminal defense lawyer, or she wants to do mergers and acquisitions, whether she wants to join the U.S. Attorney's Office, what she wants to do. We don't know that yet, but we're going to put together snippets of conversation about what she had done in the past, why it is she wanted to go to law school, et cetera, et cetera. Again, can I say more probably than not all these things would have happened? No. But what's my alternative? I really don't have an alternative. So we're going to do this business of saying this is what I think she would have done in the same way that we make up a story about what we think Kenneth Rice would have done. And then we hope it's reasonably accurate. Okay, So there's going to be this period of time when she would have been in law school. Actually, the income is, you know, down here, as you well know. But eventually, we turn that around, and she's on the upward slope here. And we just run the numbers. But there's a problem here, apparently. And I think I stopped you before we laid the stuff on the table initially in terms of what's the basic, first of all, what law do we apply here? Whose law? But which, again, this is all state specific. Is it the law of New York? Is it the law of Pennsylvania? Yes, it's Connecticut law. And this is actually one of the topics that you eventually wind up talking about in civil procedure, where in a contract case, for example, your company signs a contract with a company in Colorado. Do you apply the law of Colorado? Do you apply the law of Washington? Does it matter what it says in the contract? Does it matter where the contract was supposed to be performed? These choice of law questions. In a plane crash in particular, it can be difficult to figure out, do we use the law of the state where the plane crash occurred? Do we use the law where the victims are originally from? Do we use the law of the place where the defendant does business? You know, we have all kinds of different possibilities. And obviously, the plaintiff's going to go, as we say, forum shopping for that body of law that's most favorable to the plaintiff. And there's no law, quite the opposite, that says they can't do that. But the court then has the difficult task of identifying, okay, which law does apply. We've solved that problem here. That all took place in the background, and it turns out Connecticut law is the one we're using for this case. So now let us look to see, what does Connecticut say is the measure of damage in a wrongful death case? First of all, let's answer the who question. Who's being compensated? Yes, this is all on the survival statute side. It turns out, as in the last case, that the beneficiary of this estate, at the end of the pipeline here, is her husband, Reed Feldman. So if it had been a wrongful death statute, it wouldn't have changed the ultimate beneficiary, but it does change our perspective about what we're measuring. The idea here is to compensate the estate of Nancy Feldman for the damage she suffered from being killed just on the verge of starting law school. And now the what question. What does the Connecticut statute include? So it's her capacity as a lawyer. Again, what kind of a lawyer we don't know yet. We will never know, as it turns out. But we try to do the best job we can projecting the capacity that she had as a lawyer. And again, it would be relevant, just as it was with Mrs. O'Shea or with other cases, to take testimony. What kind of a student was Nancy Feldman? What sort of a lawyer would she have turned into? What were her interests, her skills, her aptitudes? And if you're the plaintiff, you would like to hear testimony about how brilliant and how hardworking and how phenomenally well connected she was, and everything she touched turned to gold. That's the kind of thing that makes her earning capacity sound on the high end. If you're the defendant, you may want to go collect evidence that maybe it wasn't quite like that. But again, you're in the tough position of who wants to speak ill of the dead. Who wants to be put in that position? But that evidence, of course, is relevant, and if the plaintiff gets too inflated in their portrait of this, you know, Saint Nancy, the defense may be entitled to say, not so fast. Okay. So we look at earning capacity. What else? Yes. So again, if Nancy Feldman had not been a, you know, promising law student here, but instead had been disabled, she's mentally retarded. Is her loss, well, where's the damage? No. the question would be, under Connecticut law, she's just as entitled to recover for the loss of life's non-remunerative activities. So you could ask under Connecticut law for a very large recovery because this other Nancy, this disabled Nancy, really enjoyed life. And when she was killed in this plane crash, we lost one of the great enjoyers of life. And let me tell you about how Nancy spent her day and the joy that she brought to other people. And again, there's not a dry eye in the house when I'm done. If that's the measure of damage, I get to ask for that. And, you know, a plaintiff's lawyer who will take that on can earn quite a large recovery for the client and for himself or herself, as the case may be. Okay, now, the question is, how did the trial judge balance these two things out? The trial judge did what? Of course, she never said this, right? This is our part of our imagination about what we think she would have done, but okay. Would have made, yeah. Yeah, the trial judge says, I don't know how to deal with this really, but why don't we just forget all about that? Let's just sort of assume that she kept working. And again, you could read this in 2003, look back in 1975 and say, what planet is he on? You know, that's not the way women work in the real world. But again, at least in theory, we are not speaking of the generality about women, except to the extent that maybe these serve as predictors. What we should be looking at is, what would Nancy have done? What's the best evidence? If Nancy's been, you know, listening to Dr. Laura, you know, and is going to take her life in a different direction, or she's been listening to, you know, somebody with a very different perspective, then that's the light we should follow. We're trying to figure out the most accurate crystal ball prediction of what this individual would have done, not what I would have done if I were in her place or what the majority of people would have done. So again, you can look at this and say, this is really weird because I'm sort of playing God here. I'm making up, or I'm at least playing fiction writer. I'm making up this scenario and erasing this little thing and adding a character there and, you know, changing the plot line. It may seem kind of weird, but we don't really have a choice. We're kind of stuck with this. Again, working with what the legislature has given us by way of criteria. Now, there is this grumpy, the concurring dubitante. Judge Friendly, again in his curmudgeonly way, says, Judge not so friendly perhaps, says, I don't like any of this stuff. I particularly don't like the fact that Nancy Feldman, actually Reed Feldman, gets his boatload of money, and this poor struggling family who lost their husband, wasn't it Mr. Perry? Yeah. Mr. Perry goes down on the same plane, and he gets about, what is it, two-thirds of what Reed Feldman gets, and Reed doesn't need the money, says Friendly. Is that relevant? Again, as you look at the victims of the World Trade Center 9/11 attack, should we give the same amount of money to the family of the janitor as to the stockbroker? What about the, you know, single stockbroker who doesn't really have anybody financially dependent on him, whereas the janitor leaves, you know, a family that was scraping by on the $20,000 he brought home. Relevant? Give the same to everybody? This is not a very pleasant business that we're in here, and it forces us to put these values in places we just didn't want to go. But what's our alternative? Maybe, you know, you could construct an alternative that says, when somebody dies, here's what you get. It's the same, whether you're Bill Gates or whether you're the homeless guy on the streets. A person is a person. Or you may say, well, not quite. But again, ultimately, it's the legislature in whose hands, you know, we place this, and the legislature may or may not do something that we think is very good. We'll pick that up again tomorrow here.
Right.